Welcome to Adventist Voices. I'm Alexander Carpenter, and I want to wish you a Happy New Year from me and all of the folks who support Spectrum. We're looking forward to a new year with all of you exploring Adventism and the larger world of spirituality and social justice, peacemaking. And to kick it off for this podcast, I am very honored to share my conversation with Dr. Larry Garrity. As you'll hear in this conversation, we explore everything from his early life to how he fell in love and won over his wife, Jillian, as well as the twists and turns of his career, how he ended up at Harvard, and some lessons he's learned both as an administrator in multiple institutions and someone who has been present at incredible moments in Adventist history, including the drafting of the fundamental beliefs at the GC session, and also attending Glacier View. So I am kicking off a series that will be periodically returning to this year, where I have extended interviews with legends in Adventism, folks that have had incredible careers. And honestly, I just want to have a conversation with them and learn something about this faith and culture that we share, and also learn some lessons about how to survive and flourish in our community from them. So this is going to be split into two parts because the conversation is so in-depth. So you'll be hearing the first half this week, and then we'll release the second half next week. And of course, as always, I want to hear your thoughts, so feel free to email me at acarpenter@puc.edu. Thank you very much for listening, and I wish you all the best in this year as we explore hope and faith together.
Yes, I knew, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget it.
Well, I thought it would be helpful to maybe begin with your earliest memory of something connected to Adventism.
My earliest memories are from the village that we lived in during World War II in central China. We were behind Japanese lines in a little village that had no vehicular traffic. There were no roads to this village. The only way you could get there was on sampans on the river. And it was an Adventist college that my parents both taught at. We were the only foreigners in the village, and so all my playmates were Chinese. So I grew up speaking Chinese quite well. And so I have many memories of that home and the interaction with people there. Of course, Sabbaths were special, as in any Adventist community, with church and services and so forth. One of the earliest sort of connections to the outside world that I remember was the death of President Roosevelt, because as I was lying down for my nap, my mother was crying, and I said, "Mom, you know, why are you crying?" And she said, "I've just heard that our president has died." But missionaries would sometimes come through. We would have special visits from people. We would have visits from GIs who were Adventists, who were part of, you know, the armed services. So those are the kinds of memories that I had as I was growing up in that little village.
Can you talk about when you first remember sort of having maybe a culture clash between the missionary Adventist milieu that you were a part of and what we might call kind of North American Adventism? Did it flow seamlessly for you? Did you feel like you kind of went between those two worlds, or was there a time when you thought, well, that's really different, or, you know, that's not what I believe or feel that it's normal?
One of the culture clashes that I had was coming back from the mission field to high school in the United States. I came to San Pasquale Academy as a junior, from having spent my teenage years in Lebanon. And I found academy culture hard to get used to. I mean, the conversations that people had were all about pop music and girls and cars and sports. And those were not things that I was used to. I mean, I missed conversations about history and religion and politics and things like that. I got a job working in the tool shed as a sort of tool boy, and the kids loved teasing me. I mean, they would come and say, you know, I need stripe paint. And so I would try to find that on the shelf, or they would want left-handed wrenches. And I thought, well, you know, what are those, and so forth. So they quickly found out that I was from another age and another continent. But eventually I adapted, and it didn't take too long. But I remember thinking, you know, this is a very alien culture that I've come to.
So you say that you felt like you adapted. Was there a point where you made a decision to kind of, I don't know what the best way to put it, perhaps be more immersed or a part of, you know, American culture? Was it something that just happened kind of as you were assimilating? Was there a part of you that always felt like an outsider?
Yeah, I tried to adapt. I thought this is my new culture. I've got to be a part of it. And when the guys in the dorm said, we have a custom here called door slamming, you know, and we all do it at the same time. So I remember saying, okay, well, I'll be part of this group. And so at the given signal, we all started slamming doors, you know, and I didn't know that when the dean came around the corner that you were supposed to stop. And so I was the only one who got into trouble for slamming my door, you know, and I thought, so they sort of set me up, you know, for these kinds of situations. But I learned to adapt, there were no really serious problems.
So let's talk a little bit about your parents and the influence that they were on you. Obviously, they were an influence in connecting you to very many cultures, mm-hmm. and they introduced you to Adventism. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about a strong memory from your father that you think helped define your relationship with him?
My father was a convert from Roman Catholicism, and he continued to have that kind of devotion to the church and to God. And he was I would say a strict disciplinarian and believed in following the rules and did not appear to be much of a questioner of tradition and rules and what had been received from the church. So he transferred his allegiance from the Catholic Church to the Adventist Church and more or less accepted it. It appeared to me hook, line, and sinker. And so I grew up in a home that was very traditional. We always had morning worships, evening worships. We read from scripture daily. We guarded the edges of the Sabbath, always prepared for the Sabbath. Sabbath meals were special times. I grew up in a home that was loving. My parents never fought. They got along well, even though they had their own opinions sometimes. But I felt loved and appreciated and supported, sometimes disciplined. But I experienced my dad as a person of integrity, somebody that stood for what was right, and somebody who was gracious and considerate. So he certainly was an influence on me. And as I never anticipated becoming an administrator such as he was, but when I did, I think that subconsciously he was a role model.
I want to return to your mother in a minute, but let's follow that role model of being an administrator, because we're kind of jumping around. Do you mind talking about perhaps a moment in your administrative career where you were, faced with a decision between maybe the Adventism that you grew up with and the Adventism that you found true for you, or more authentic? And how did you choose between, say the Adventism of the 40s and 50s and the Adventism that was increasingly a part of your generation's experience, at least as you were understanding it?
Well, when I say that my father was very loyal to the church and followed its dictates and so on, yet he had a personal ethic that demonstrated his independence. I remember during the Mary Kay Silver controversy at the Pacific Press, he turned up at the court hearing in the Bay Area, and his colleagues from the General Conference who were standing at the door to the court said, "Oh, good, Tom, we're so glad to see you here. We need all the help we can get." And he said, "I'm here to support Mary Kay." And they were shocked that, he was an employee of the General Conference. They expected him to toe the line. And he said, "But there's a question of equity and justice that's involved, that's higher than our traditions, And so there was that kind of influence in the background as well. While my dad was a traditionalist, yet there were certain ethics that trumped tradition, if you want to put it that way. And so I think that my experience as administrator has perhaps been influenced by that kind of an example too. I mean, I believe in authority, and I believe in cooperation, and I believe in working with the system. But it has to be open to criticism at the right times. And so there have been times in my experience where I had to buck the system due to belief in in justice and equity when that didn't seem to be in play.
Is there a time when you felt you paid a cost for choosing justice over conformity?
Yes, in the short run, but I think in the long run, I have benefited from that. I ran into short-term problems, maybe, and developed a certain kind of reputation that were problematic, maybe, in certain areas. But in the long run, I think that I've been able to get along and serve the church and society just the same.
Yeah. Well, let's return to your parentage and your mother. In what way do you feel like she influenced your view of the world and who you are?
My mother was always my best friend. She had empathy. And I knew that she had my back. And entering my teenage years, when a lot of kids have problems, I had my share, I suppose. But she had a knack for being around at the right time to have a conversation. You know, maybe late at night, she would start ironing in a room where I was just to be there, you know. Oh, nice. And I would begin to talk, and she would listen, and she would ask questions, and she was definitely somebody whose love I could count on, and was a very strong influence in my life.
So you've talked about arriving back in the U.S. and you've talked about going to San Pasquale Academy. Obviously, then you went on to Pacific Union College.
Before that, from San Pasquale, I went to Cologne.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then for 3 years, I went to Newbold College. And the reason for my going to Newbold was, frankly, to pursue Jillian, who I had grown up with in Lebanon, and she was British and in England. And it was only after securing her commitment to marry me that I ended up for my senior year at Pacific Union College.
Good. Well, that's where I wanted to go, and you intuited that we needed those details. So thank you. Can you talk about... as you say, securing her commitment to marry you. How did that happen?
You know, my parents moved from China to the Middle East at the time that the Chinese communists took over China. And so the church, and of course, foreigners had to leave. So the church moved my dad to Middle East College in Beirut, Lebanon. And that was an institution that my future father-in-law, Arthur Keogh, had founded back in 1939. My dad came to be the president of that institution. And so the Keoghs were still there in the community. And my mom became the church school teacher for the missionary kids, among whom were the Keogh children. And Jillian, the eldest Keogh child, and I were two of the older students in my mom's classroom. And that's where I got to know Jillian. And it was interesting. My mom would use the Keogh children as an example to the rest of us. You know, they were cultured and they obeyed the rules. And if you could all be like the Keogh children, you know, you'd have it made. So I had that influence about from my mom. But I had a good time with Jillian as a friend. We developed a natural relationship. We worked on MV honors together. We would go hiking. We had long conversations since we were the eldest kids in our families and we were neighbors. We would help each other with our younger siblings, or we would help with each other with chores at home, that sort of thing. And so when we moved back to California and I went to San Pasqual, my dad was, the reason we had come back to California was my dad wanted to finish his doctorate at USC. And so I missed Jillian and I missed that friendship and companionship. And while there were lots of fine girls in academy, none quite came up to the standard that I was used to with Jillian.
Keogh standard.
That's right. So so when I was thinking about college, I was back home in Beirut with my parents and was actually planning to go to Pacific Union College, but I got a letter from Jillian, who was at Newbold, and she said, why don't you come to Newbold to college? And so I went over to her parents and I said, what do you think of this idea? You know, and her dad said, oh, you won't like England. It rains all the time and the food is terrible and so on. He had sent his daughter home to England to marry a Britisher. Mm. And I don't know if that was in his mind when he said those things or not. But anyway, her mom said, no, she said, England is a beautiful place. The food is fine. And I think that would be a great idea for you to go, you know? So anyway, I quickly canceled my arrangements for PUC and started the arrangements for Newbold. And I told Jillian in a letter the time I would be arriving, and she said that she would meet me at the airport. And sure enough, she did with her boyfriend. And so that was a surprise.
Interesting.
So it took me a while to solidify this relationship. And she, looking back on it, she said she knew that we were good friends and she felt that we were going to end up together, but mm-hmm. she felt I was too serious about it. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't ready to sort of settle down in that kind of a relationship. And so I had to wait a couple of years until one day her parents were on furlough in England and they were at a nearby town. They often invited me home for lunch on Sabbath. And Jillian and I were washing dishes after Sabbath lunch. And she said something about, oh, I asked her, you know, why she wasn't willing to spend more time with me. And she said, well, she says, I don't really know you that well. I said, well, whose fault is that? Mm. She said, well, if you get permission from Newbold to date me, I'll give it a try. And at Newbold during that time, if you were going to date somebody, you had to have faculty permission. That seems quaint, doesn't it? But they had three categories, A, B, and C. And if you were category C, you could date in groups. And if you had category B, you had to have a chaperone. And if you're in category A, you could date on your own. And so she said, if you get a category A, I'll go out with you. So I applied for a category A relationship to date. And they said, the faculty person that I talked to said, but she's already dating another guy. And I said, I know, but she said that if I get category A, she will date me. Okay, they said, we'll take it to the faculty. So the word came back from Robert Olson, who was at that time the president of Newbold. And he said, the faculty has granted you category A. Jillian Keough is a fine person. You probably have to learn to break her will, though, he said. Oh. And so I've often said that I've tried for, you know, many years to do that, but it's never worked. Anyway, she was at a teacher training college nearby working on her British teaching degree. And so when she came Sabbath morning to church at Newbold, I had in hand the category A permission letter, and I showed it to her, and she started to cry. And she said to me later, I knew that was it. Mm. We were going to be together for life. And it worked well. And ever since we've had a great relationship.
Well, if you can't beat the Keoughs, join them.
That's right. That's right. Oh, dear.
That's really a fascinating history. And it's a great glimpse into kind of that era of Adventism as well, and how they ran institutions.
That's true.
So when you first got married, where did you and Jillian live?
We got married in 1962, the Sunday after the General Conference session ended in San Francisco at the Cow Palace. Mm-hmm. Her parents were delegates to the General Conference that year. And of course, they had to come from Lebanon, so that was a long way. So we took advantage of that to make that the time. And I had just graduated that spring from Civic Union College and was headed to the seminary at Andrews. We were married in the Deer Park Church, the Sanitarium Church,
yeah,
where Jillian's uncle was a member and was the head elder. And so I was employed by the Central California Conference to be a call porter leader for student call porters that summer. And so we got married in August, and I finished up my work as a call porter and then headed for the seminary.
Hmm. And do you mind just describing a little bit about the kind of early days of making, you know, starting a career? Mm-hmm. Call porter work, as I can attest, is difficult. You're starting a new family. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, you know, what you want to do. I think, you know, you have a whole life that you have led afterward. What were some of the experiences there as sort of a new husband, a new father, a new Adventist employee that you think shaped you as you were in those early days?
Well, Jillian and I were, you know, both, one of the advantages of that relationship was that we, you know, for 70 years now, we've had the same friends, the same experience and so on. And so from very close to the beginning of our lives, we've known each other and have a common background from the mission field and parents who are committed to the church and so forth. So, we have not had struggles that maybe some couples may have had. And my last year at PUC, she taught at Napa Junior Academy. And then we got married, and she knew that she was marrying a minister and that our lives would be committed to denominational service. We hoped to the mission field. We both had grown up there. We offered ourselves to the Middle East Division as potential missionaries, but the division president wasn't interested in us. So, the Far Eastern Division was. So they gave us a call to teach at Hong Kong Adventist College, to be a pastor and to be a teacher. And we accepted that, but we asked them for a year's experience in the United States before going over. I felt like I didn't want to to arrive this completely fresh and new, you know, without having had a little experience. And so the Southeastern California Conference agreed to, when I finished seminary, to give me experience at Santa Ana Church, Broadway Church. So that's where I got started. And so Jillian, while we were at Andrews, finished up her American bachelor's degree in education. And she started the kindergarten program for the elementary school there while I did my work. So we were both in school and working. And summers, I canvassed, colportered to help with our expenses. In fact, I colported 7 summers, both for academy, for college, and for graduate school. During 7 summers, I worked to get tuition money and so forth. So Jillian and I both felt committed to the church and to mission service. But it was during that year of service in Santa Ana that the General Conference approached and said, Siegfried Horn at Andrews University wants you to come and teach in the seminary, Hebrew Bible, archaeology, and so on, and eventually succeed him. And I said, well, that would be a wonderful opportunity, but I've already accepted a commitment in Hong Kong, and they've been waiting for us this year. So I turned down that call. And the General Conference came back to me and said, he's determined that you're the one he wants, and it would be easier to find a replacement for you in Hong Kong than to satisfy Horn. So we really wished you would do that, you know. So I talked to Horn, and I said, if I were to do this, it would obviously mean going back to school, getting a doctorate before I would come and teach. And he said, yes. And said, where would you recommend? He said, well, the best place right now is Harvard. Well, there were a couple of professors there, Frank Moore Cross and Jernest Wright, who are well known in the field. He said, they're the ones that I wish you could study with. So Jillian and I prayed about it, and we sort of gave a Gideon's test, and we prayed that if I applied only to Harvard, and I thought, you know, not everybody gets in to Harvard, so it'd be very easy to have that turned down. So I prayed that if I got an acceptance, that would be the sign that I would do that, go to Andrews eventually, rather than to Hong Kong. And that was a very sincere prayer, not knowing what would happen. So when I was accepted, that's what set me on that course. And that's how I ended up teaching at Andrews.
That's fascinating. Can you talk about your relationship with Siegfried Horn, both as a student and then as a colleague and as someone who influenced you?
Yeah. The first time I met him was when I was a 7-year-old and we were on furlough, Washington, D.C. My dad did a couple of quarters at the seminary on furlough. And in the stairwell where we lived, there were several apartments for seminary students. And in came Siegfried Horn and his wife. They had just come from Walla Walla, where he had spent a year finishing up his American bachelor's, having been a missionary in the Dutch East Indies, where he was incarcerated by the Dutch during World War II. When the Germans overran Holland in a lightning a strike, the Dutch in the Dutch East Indies were so incensed at the Germans that they immediately imprisoned all the Germans who were living in, you know, what became Indonesia. So Horn got caught up in that since he was German. And that's a long and fascinating story, how he was transferred from Indonesia to India to the British when the Japanese came down into Indonesia. And in that transfer, he was put on the wrong ship. In other words, there were four ships taking all these prisoners, and there happened to be two men with a surname Horn, and they got onto the wrong ships, according to the manifests. And the one that he was supposed to have been on was torpedoed with loss of all life at sea. And so his wife back home in Jakarta was notified that he was drowned. And for the rest of the war, he ended up in India in a prison camp in the Himalayas. So he kept writing to her, but none of his letters ever got through. And she thought he was dead. And at the end of the war, she ended up in Washington, D.C. as a nurse, met another guy, and they were about to be married when Siegfried Horn turns up.
Incredible.
And so, I mean, it was a shock, you know, to the both of them what had happened. Anyway, here the Horns moved in 1947 into this apartment building where we were, and I was a kid, you know, and all my memories are of him being very Germanic and very intent on what he was doing and not very friendly. And, you know, we just pass each other in the halls and so on. But I learned a little bit about his story and how he was interested in archaeology, and he was, you know, going to go work on a doctorate and so forth. Well, my folks and we, of course, went back to the Middle East. But Horn turns up on a visit to Middle East College on his first visit to the Holy Land. And he's wanting to visit all these things that he has known about, studied about, and so on. And this, he lectured at the college. I attended his lectures as a teenager, found them fascinating. He talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls having just been discovered and so forth. And a couple years later, he came back on a tour. He was taking ministers on a tour. And I said to him, any chance I could join your tour? And he very kindly let me, as a teenager, join his tour. We visited Jerusalem and Egypt and so on. And so I developed an interest in archaeology, having grown up as a teenager there in the Middle East. And I traveled with my parents, went to, you know, Iran and Iraq and Jerusalem and Turkey and Egypt and so forth. And so watched archaeologists at work, got acquainted with Horn. And I thought that would be an interesting career. But when I was at the seminary, I thought, you know, how would I be employed as an archaeologist? There didn't seem to be much. So I ended up thinking I'll go into the ministry. But I took all of the courses that Horn offered and did well in them. I didn't know he had any interest in me particularly. I mean, when I'd go into his office to talk to him, I always got the feeling that the sooner you ask your question and get the answer, the better, because I'm busy, you know? I mean, I always had that feeling. So it wasn't as though he particularly showed an interest in me that I knew of. But I guess because we had this long I wouldn't call it a relationship, but we knew each other, and I had done well in his classes, and I guess that's what led to his wanting me to come. So I certainly have him to thank for the way my career has developed.
As you were headed off to Harvard instead of Hong Kong, mm-hmm. What were your thoughts as you were moving from really being ensconced in Adventist education and Adventist missionary culture mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. being in Cambridge, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and you know, sitting at the feet of folks who maybe shared your interests in archaeology, but maybe not your faith.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that certainly was a formative period. It was the 60s, and the American society was in turmoil because of the Vietnam War and so on. And that was constantly on everybody's mind, you know, in the community and at the university. I remember how differently my two major professors reacted to what was going on. I remember Frank Cross saying to me one day, "I can't believe Harvard is supposed to be the cream of the crop of American young people, and they're out demonstrating, and they're not coming to classes." And he said, you know, they're not taking seriously their vocation. Whereas Jernest Wright, he got a crate and brought it out in front of the classroom and put it on the street corner. And he stood up and he said, you know, if this was Amos here, this is what he would say about the issues that you're dealing with, you know. Yeah. And so I had these two demonstrations of a way to handle the issues that were going on. Jernest Wright was a Presbyterian minister, and he knew, of course, that I was headed eventually to Andrews when I got through. He knew Horn. He assigned me a topic in my first year to present a paper in this seminar. The custom was graduate students would be, they would decide on a overall topic. This year happened to be the 13th century BC. And so your paper had to somehow be related to that century in time. And he asked me to do a paper on the background of the conquest in the 13th century BC. Well, I already knew that I would run into problems because having come from the seminary and for Siegfried Horn, the dating of the Exodus be around 1400, and then the conquest would be the 14th century. So there was going to be a problem, but my professor had written books on the subject, and I knew the secondary literature and a more a critical approach to chronology and to the interpretation of the evidence and so on. I don't know whether he specifically assigned that to me, knowing that this would be a problem or not, but it was my first test. Hmm. So I worked very hard on this paper, and I couldn't find evidence for an Israelite destruction of cities during the 13th century the way my professor had written it up. So in a long footnote, I gave an alternative position that it was essentially Horn's position, you know. And the custom was your paper had to be done 2 weeks ahead of time, and it was passed around to all the professors and students who had a chance to read it. And then when you came to the seminar, you were assigned a faculty and a student critic, and then there was a discussion of your paper. Well, as soon as this paper was passed out, my fellow students came to me and said, "Garrity, your goose is cooked. I mean, you're differing with our professor. He's on record. You know what you have to say, you know." And I said, "Yeah, but I mean, I've done my work and I stand by what I've said, you know." So they brought coffee and donuts to seminar that day, which didn't usually happen. They wanted to enliven the atmosphere, make it more congenial, because they thought this was going to be the end of my time there. And it turned out that Jernest Wright himself was my faculty critic, that another fellow student also. And he never dealt with my archaeological evidence. Hmm. And he treated the scriptural passages from a what we would call a higher critical point of view and made room for his theory that way, but not with the archaeology, which was the main point. Well, and he wouldn't look at me, I didn't feel. And I felt like I'm really in trouble, you know. So I had a hard time sleeping that night. I said to Jillian, you know, I'm sure this is a problem. So the next morning I went in to his office, made an appointment to talk to him. And I said, I know that you're not happy with me. I've done my best. And, you know, he said, look, he says, I know you're a Horn student and I know your background. And he said, let me tell you this, that I see myself as a conservative. When he said, I was working on my doctrine, nobody believed in the Bible. And he said, to make room for an exodus was a very avant-garde thing to do, because most people at the time I went to school didn't even believe an exodus occurred and so forth. You know, so he says, I see myself as arguing to support biblical history. And he said, I don't want to change your points of view, but he said, this is what's important to me, that you know the evidence and that you're fair to it. And if you do that, that's what an education here is supposed to, you know, do. And he said, to tell you the truth, I'll never be able to as confidently talk about my views as I have to heretofore. So he says, your paper was a solid piece of work. He said, by the way, I'm looking for a teaching assistant next year. Would you be willing to be my, you know, I was blown away.
Incredible.
I went home to Jillian and I said, I have a truly great professor, you know. And so you can see that experience was extremely influential in my outlook, my overall view, the way to treat people, the way to handle students, evidence, so forth, you know. So.
You survived.
I survived.
And flourished. Yeah. While we're there in your time at Harvard, can you talk about your interaction with other Adventist graduate students and how the Adventist Forum began to form?
Yes. Roy Branson just preceded me. He was not in residence during the time I was there, though he would come back, you know, to do some of his work and to defend his thesis and so forth. But we were friends. There were other Adventist graduate students in the Boston area, of course, and Alvin Quirum was a young professor at Harvard in the chemistry department. And he and Verla became the godfather, godmother to the group of graduate students, you know, in the area. And we would have regular meetings on campus where we would invite professors that we knew to address issues that were of interest to us, or denominational officials, or area pastors, you know, assign them a topic and have them come. And so we would have Sabbath afternoon sessions that in what we call the New England Adventist Forum.
How many people were roughly a part of it at that time?
Oh, I would say that at those meetings, there would be 30, 40 people, something like that. I remember having some of the, a couple of times when we had noted evolutionists, you know, who were teaching in biology and so on, come talk to us about some of the issues that we were interested in. So the topics varied a great deal from things that would be of interest to specific graduate students. And we were all learning the critical skills that are necessary in research and in our various disciplines. What we had in common was not our discipline, but our church. And so it was natural to turn these newly honed critical skills that were important for our disciplines on the church and on our faith, the thing that we had in common. And it was out of that yeasty time that we had a retreat with other graduate students from New York at Camp Berkshire. And we talked about a wider organization. And some of us knew graduate students in Chicago and Seattle and Berkeley and so forth. And there began a discussion about why not get our various groups together and start an organization that would facilitate graduate students' relationship to the church. And from the standpoint of helping to keep these people in the church and active with the church, you know. And so that's how the Adventist Forum started. And people like Roy Branson and Alvin Quirin were very, very important to its development and to the starting of Spectrum, because we felt we needed a journal where some of these studies could be published and so forth.
I've got one more question on that early period, and that is, you talked about the application of the sort of critical academic scholarly approaches that you were using, and turning that onto the church, and thinking about your faith. Can you describe a little bit of the tensions that existed for you personally? Was there, you've talked about chronology. I know at the Andrews Seminary, chronology was very important. Deep into king lineages and making sure the Bible was accurate. Obviously, the Adventist Church cares about chronology when they're talking about the prophecies or the creation. Mm-hmm. So that's just one area. What I'm curious about is there something was there one a doctrine or an ethic that that you remember being central to your own experience that you sort of struggled through, that you felt like, wow, this is, you know, the way that the evidence looks to me now is absolutely different than what all these church leaders believe. And, you know, I've got to figure out how I can remain an Adventist and be true to my intellectual connection to reality. Mm-hmm.
Well, I found my studies, my academic and research studies in my department actually strengthened my faith in the importance of scripture. I mean, I could see that there's historical background that verifies the biblical history in general, you know, and archaeology is very useful in throwing light and elucidating that background. And around the edges, there's certainly changes that needed to be made or new light that we had and so on. But basically, the Bible is an accurate account of the human past. But the problem, of course, is with the first few chapters of Genesis, which really cannot be history, their theology.
Sure.
And that is something that the church still doesn't see clearly, in my view. But if it's going to move into the future with success and retain its thinking people, it's got to make some, it has to grow in that area. But that's, you know, it's the first 11 chapters of Genesis that where the biggest problems are. I think that that most other areas of doctrine are compatible, you know, we can get along with.
Mm-hmm. Was there a point, was that something that you understood, or was understanding that something that happened gradually? Was it an aha moment in grad school? Was it something that you felt you had to be honest about as a new professor at the seminary? Was it something that came later? I'm curious about especially that understanding of the first 11 chapters.
I think that it was gradual. I was asked by the forum to give a talk on the Genesis genealogies as an index of time. Malaris Kaparis, the first editor of Spectrum, heard that talk and asked me for Spectrum. And I said, I didn't prepare this for publication. I said, this is an oral thing. You know, he said, yeah, but you showed a lot of charts and you had illustrated and so on. And that we really need that. He was interested in that topic himself, you know, mm-hmm. So he felt this would be helpful. So I reluctantly worked it over and gave it to him for publication. And that has, in a way, typed me for my whole denominational career, that publication, because it caused a stir. People at Geoscience, people in the General Conference, and there was correspondence about it among the various denominational officials and the people at the seminary and so on. But I survived it. And Siegfried Horn told me, he said, I was surprised to see you publish that. He says, I believe everything you said, but I wouldn't have said it, you know. So he was a lot more cautious, but he supported me, and key people did. And somehow I survived that. But it continued to, in a way, that reputation, negative reputation in the church, haunt me. Because many years later, when I was the archaeology editor for Ministry Magazine and Spangler was the editor, I would every month have a different article that would be helpful to ministers. Some of them I wrote, some of them I invited from other people. And one day Spangler called me into his office and he said, Larry, he said, I hate to tell you this, but he said, you know, your name on our masthead is sort of an embarrassment. And I said, why is that? Well, he said, the article you wrote for Spectrum, you know, on the Genesis genealogies. I said, have you read it? He said, no. I said, well, then what do you know about it? Well, he says, people are talking about it. I said, that was 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And it's now becoming a problem? And he said, well, you know, apparently. I said, well, what about the articles that I've been supplying you month after month? Have those been helpful or are those problematic? And he turned red and he said, you know, I haven't read any of them. And he was the editor, you know, of Ministry Magazine. I said, well, I've got plenty of other things to do. I don't need to do this. I certainly don't want to be an embarrassment. And so I resigned my responsibility there. And since then, they've had very few articles on archaeology, you know, in Ministry Magazine. But it just illustrates that these things pop up from time to time. People type you in a certain way. But I don't know if that
that's really
to the issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's so much how the unfortunately a lot of folks experience the church, is that if you, you know, work through, if you're intellectually honest, that can be used against you.
Right.
Church.
Well, I hate to cut in here, but this is a two-part episode. And so please tune in next week as we explore more about the founding of the Adventist Forum and Spectrum, as well as listen to some incredible anecdotes from Adventist history lived by Dr. Garrity. He'll also be sharing some lessons he learned as an institutional leader for several decades. Thank you so much for listening, and I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts. Bye-bye.
Yes, I knew Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget.